ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय, ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय, ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। And we're going to be reading from a chapter called The Churning of the Milk Ocean. And it's a really fascinating pastime. Once the ocean was starting to be churned, a lot of things were coming out of the ocean. And we're going to hear about one personality in particular who came out of the ocean and who she was trying to find shelter in. And that personality is Lakshmi Devi. And who did she want to find her shelter in? Lord Vishnu. Yeah. So the actual topic of the class that I got on the when I got the topic is why Lakshmi chose Vishnu. So I was thinking a lot about this topic and how we can make it relevant in our lives too. Like why have we chosen Krishna, for example? So that's what we're going to talk about today, like the kind of what happened with her, and then also how does that apply to our lives. So I'm going to just jump around a little bit, and then we'll do the verse that we're going to do today. So, and you can just listen; you don't necessarily have to follow because it's kind of here and there. So from the churning of the milk ocean, there appeared the goddess of fortune, Lakshmi Devi. She's also known as Rama, who is absolutely dedicated to being enjoyed by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So she's kind of like a daughter of the ocean. She's coming out of the ocean with this pastimes happening. And a lot of other things came out first. There was one of the things that came out of the ocean was the gem that Krishna wears on his chest. Do you know the name of that gem? Yeah, Kaustubha gem. And then also the Parijata flower came out. So pretty cool things. And then these apsaras and all these different amazing personalities were coming out of this churning. So then Lakshmi Devi came. She appeared like electricity, surpassing the lightning that might illuminate a marble mountain. So quite like a profound moment. Like she comes out in this brilliant light, right? And she's so beautiful. Her description of her beauty is given. And in one of the purports, Prabhupada says, if one wants the favor of the goddess of fortune, because that's who she is, Lakshmi is the goddess of fortune, because she is by nature very wants to please Krishna, Bhagavat Para, one must keep her with Krishna in order to get her favor. You have to keep Lakshmi Devi in the context of Krishna. So Prabhupada stresses that a few times in these purports in this chapter, that goddess of fortune is desirable for everyone. Who here's ever kind of wished they had more money, for example? Anyone? Human experience, most of us, right? If you haven't, then that's pretty cool because that means you're renounced from that particular desire. But yeah, I think most of us can relate to that, like wanting something, some more comforts or some more whatever, assets or money or some sort of wealth. And that's the goddess of fortune is the one who gives that. So she's desirable for everyone, including human beings. But one should understand that the goddess of fortune is the exclusive property of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One can't achieve her mercy unless one prays both to her and to the Supreme Enjoyer, the Personality of Godhead. I thought that was really interesting. Prabhupada says you pray both to her and to Krishna. So, like if we're, I was thinking in the context of raising funds for projects like Krishna House and so on, that she's actually a personality and we can pray to her for her mercy to send like her energy our way, in the construction of the Krishna house. So the one point I wanted to just touch on here, it says she appeared out of the ocean and she is absolutely dedicated to being enjoyed by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Such an interesting phrase. That's her enjoyment is to be of service to Krishna. And that's actually all of our at the end of the day, that's our enjoyment as well. To be enjoyed by Krishna is our greatest joy. In this immaterial world, we don't understand this concept very well. It can feel like maybe for some people it can seem kind of strange to want to be enjoyed by another person. It sounds almost like you're just kind of an object of that person's desire or something. But as a jiva that's part of Krishna, like we get our greatest joy by being an instrument of Krishna and being used for him in his pleasure. So any thoughts or questions so far on that? Yeah, Ananda. Anything so far? Yeah.
I was just thinking that it's really easy when you're in the ashram that all the money goes towards Krishna conscious activities, because that's what, you're a non-profit, it all has to be used accordingly, and it's all for preaching. And but I think it's always a point to be stressed when people enter into Grihastha ashram, that because they tend to come into more money with working and, well, working, basically having a career and coming into more money, is to remember to always keep it engaged in Krishna's service, because then that's how, I know there was a devotee in Boston who gave so generously that every time he gave so much more would come, and then he would give more. And, you know, it's just exactly that. If it's connected with Krishna, it's, that's her splendor, that she's connected with Krishna. So for Grihastha to always remember that, keeping their Lakshmi connected with Krishna and all of their, at least most of it in their endeavors, so that she's not, so that it's, because when you separate Lakshmi from Narayan or from Krishna, it's Maya, right? That's what Ravana stole, a Maya version of Sita, because he separated her from Ram. And so then it became the Maya version. So money can be very entangling if it's not always kept connected with Krishna.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that point up. It's really, really important. I'm grateful that somehow my father was really like, he would like emphasize that a lot. So as a kid, I saw him, he would talk about that a lot, like the importance of tithing and staying connected with your resources to projects of spiritual value, so that you're purifying your wealth and that you're connecting it back to Krishna. And then he had that like really strong faith, because he wasn't like, we weren't really well to do or anything, but we were, you know, we just kind of made a way and we made our way in this world. But he had that strong faith that if he just gave right off the top from his paycheck, that he would always, that Krishna would always provide, and somehow Krishna always did provide. It was really cool. So, so then I wanted to share that when she came out, there are a lot of different like personalities came out to worship her. So when Lakshmi came, then there was a bathing ceremony for her, and all these personalities took part in that bathing ceremony. And do you know who played the drums? It's very interesting. The people who played the drums, just take a guess. I'm just curious if you know. Gandharvas. Yeah, sometimes they play drums too, but in this, I don't know if you'll guess this. It's the clouds personified. They came out and played drums, and different types of drums, mridangas, panavas, murajas, anakas, and the clouds. It's interesting because they make that thunder sound. So I was like, oh, that's kind of like a sort of like a drum, right? Like, cool. So that would be really cool to see the clouds like in their personified forms, playing different drums. And great elephants came from all directions, and they were carrying big jugs full of Ganges water. And these elephants were bathing the goddess of fortune. What a cool image. And while she was being bathed, she had a lotus flower in her hand. She appeared very beautiful. And it's described that she was very chaste in her mind towards Krishna, like that was towards Vishnu, really. She was absorbed in that. So after they did this whole ceremony, and they describe her beauty here and how she, you know, she was like radiant and effulgent, she then, so here I'm going to, here we can start looking at the verses together. So you can go to verse number 19. And I'm going to ask you, we're going to do like a little exercise together here. So first I'll read this verse 19. While walking among the Gandharvas, so she's now, she's bathed and she's like there in the presence of everyone. She's walking among the Gandharvas, Yakshas, Asuras, Siddhas, charanas, and denizens of heaven, Lakshmi Devi, the goddess of fortune, was scrutinizingly examining them, but she could not find anyone naturally endowed with all good qualities. None of them was devoid of faults, and therefore she could not take shelter of any of them. So in that purport, Prabhupada says she was the daughter of the ocean, so she had this like what they call a Svayambara ceremony, where the person can choose their partner. And so she was looking around, looking for her match, like her partner, her qualified person for her. And she couldn't find that in the people around her. So text 20. So she's gonna think about, like, she's looking at, just imagine her going around, she's like looking at these people, and they're probably all like, choose me, right? They're probably all enamored with her. But so the goddess of fortune, examining the assembly, thought in this way: someone who has undergone great austerity has not yet conquered anger. So you can imagine her in her mind, she's thinking, that person there, maybe they've done this, but they haven't done that. So what I want to do now is just like a little exercise where we pause and then we just think of an example of this, like of each of these sentences, someone that you maybe know from scripture, or maybe a famous person in history, or a relevant character in our life. I mean, not someone in this room, obviously, but, you know, someone that like a kind of a prototype of a person or something that you can think of as an example for each one of these. So the first one, someone who has undergone great austerity, but has not yet conquered anger. Durvasa Muni, that was what I immediately thought too. He's just kind of always fuming, like ready to burst. So yeah, so he's like an amazing austere person, but he hasn't conquered anger. Any other thoughts for that one? Yeah, Hiranyakashipu. Yeah, he was a very angry person. Ravana, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the next one. Someone possesses knowledge, but he has not conquered material desires. Mm-hmm. So no. Yeah. Yeah, me too. So is there anybody in contemporary life in your world that you can think of just as a category of people that maybe sometimes have this issue? Professors. Yeah. Someone, anybody who is, right? Like, yeah, Shruti.
Oftentimes it's society, and you know, they might have a lot of strength and knowledge, but then, you know, they get into some scandal with the opposite sex.
Yeah, some kind of like, scandal. Yeah.
Yeah, some kind of scandal, and that's their fall down. I guess built. I don't know, but you know, there's time to time those kind of cases come out.
Yeah, political leaders and people. Yeah, Kamishi. Hmm. And do you want to elaborate on that?
Yeah, I was thinking. Yeah. I was thinking about he has the knowledge, but he couldn't. His desire was to try to get the independence of India, but his knowledge, but he couldn't use the knowledge properly. So it was kind of, he was attached to that material desire.
Interesting. Yeah. So there's, as long as there's some still a desire, or some attachment to this world and making it better, than we're not purified completely. He was quite renounced, but yeah. So maybe using knowledge in a way that was still entangling. So yeah, and you know, like when I'm just asking these questions, I want you to also reflect on how do we see this in ourselves as well, because it's easy to kind of go like, oh yeah, all those, you know, professors out there, whatever. But sometimes I, you know, we can struggle with this. Like we might get caught up in that idea. I don't know if you've ever run across someone, or if you have ever felt this way, like, oh my gosh, I know it all. I'm like, kind of like, I can't wait to show off my stuff. And then you get caught up in that, and we're not really pure, because we're still like attached to adoration or something about sharing our knowledge or so on. So someone's a very great personality, but he can't conquer lusty desires. Nishta. Adamil? Yeah, someone's a great, yeah, he was very, very advanced in his spiritual practice and then kind of got pulled back by that, yeah. Even a great personality depends on something else. That's... Yeah, yeah, that's another good example, Bharat Maharaj. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Indra.
Yeah, Brahma. Indra, yeah. So, yeah, Arjuna there.
That one sage was underwater. Fish? Mark and Andrew?
Yeah.
Shobari Muni. There's a couple. There's like two. Yeah.
Vishwamitra was attracted by the dancers.
Okay, and then Shobari Muni was attracted by the fish, like being like fish having their drama. So. Kevin? I was actually thinking about that. Yeah. I mean, that's like, yeah, I mean, that's very like, yeah, he was infamous for that particular thing. Yeah. A lot of political leaders.
You can say all the kings in the Middle East. They have like multiple wives, like
10, 5, 5, 5. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, we can see this is a really big one, actually. You can become very prominent, but then that lusty desire can be very, lust is the thing that keeps us all bound to this world, right? So next verse. So she's still going around looking and she says, someone may possess full knowledge of religion, but still not be kind to all living entities. Does any thought come to mind for that? And Prabhupada has talked about this a lot too.
Oh, yeah.
Kevin, yeah.
Certain religions, they hate exiles.
Yes, I was thinking that. Yeah, good example. And Prabhupada would get really on their case about it. He was like really, yeah, he really pointed out that irony. Yeah, no. Okay. Yeah, so, So Kevin had said that, certain, you know, religions or religious people might have slaughterhouses and might take part in that slaughter of animals. So that would be an example.
I was going to say like Mayavadis.
Do you want to elaborate a little?
Yeah. Sure. I mean, like in the East, there's a lot of enlightened people who don't like are Mayavadis. So because it's not personal, they might not be. Like they concatenate their own ways of enlightenment and they might not be kind to all living entities.
Yeah, great point. Thank you. Yeah.
The common theme in everybody like having like a fault, the boy like being having a fault is like that there's like a desire there. And like people seem to not know how to act on those desires or like how to like transcend those desires.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. Shruti.
I was thinking about how or in the course of history there's always these pastimes of like there's priests and religious people who are so much into religion and how the codes of religion have to be enforced. And they end up being, they stop realizing the principle of religion and start being unkind to people, especially when like Jesus came and even Lord Chaitanya's time, all the priests, they were corrupt and they weren't kind to the common people.
Yeah. Like even to the point of wars and murder and yeah, so on. Yeah. What a good point. Okay. The next one is in someone, whether human or demigod, there may be renunciation, but that is not the cause of liberation. It's similar to one we had before. I want to just mention something here because it can happen in our spiritual journey that we can go through a period of time like where we get really exuberant and really excited about the spiritual life that like, okay, done with this, done with that. I'm just going to be like, you know, kind of this really gung-ho maybe mentality that's not so balanced. And so maybe it like can be artificial renunciation prematurely. And what can happen with that is that can actually be unsustainable and And if we do that, it can actually lead to our kind of falling back a bit in our progress. So, and I think that we probably, have seen it in the ashram setting, just that sometimes that's not sustainable, and that people who are like super extreme, they don't end up staying around very long usually. So unless they're able to do it in a very mature and balanced way. So that's renunciation. Someone may possess great power and yet be unable to check the power of eternal time. Any thoughts on that one? Paranjana, yeah.
What was it? I think there were different metaphors in the story for time. I don't remember if it was like the soldiers dressed in black and the soldiers dressed in white. Wasn't it something? I can't remember. Yeah, days and nights. Yeah, exactly.
Mm.
So the whole purpose of the story was to say, even if you're a king, you have no control over time.
Yeah, it's a good one. Yeah, and then Prabhupada would say how even the greatest politician or person who's the most famous in this world is going to have to be on their deathbed. Like they're going to, I think he gave that story, was it a true story maybe, of the person who was like, I'm going to pay anything to try to save my life. Like I'll pay, he was like a wealthy person in India, right? Prabhupada told that he was saying like, take all my money to save my life, but that the doctors couldn't save his life. So at the end of, and Prabhupada also said that we might not want to surrender to Krishna while we're alive, but at the end of our life, everyone's going to be forced by time to just kind of like, you know, fall flat on their, to the time factor of Krishna. Yes. Dhritarashtra, do you want to say something about that?
Hare Krishna. So Dhritarashtra example is a great, great kshatriya, great king,
mm-hmm.
but yet unable to, at the right time of his life, to give up and renounce and not see that he's getting so old, he has to quit home, but yet it came over him very quick and he wasn't realizing that.
Mm, yeah. His teeth were getting loose and different things were happening in his body. Yeah. So then, okay, let's do the last one here. So someone else may have renounced attachment to the material world, yet he cannot compare to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, no one is completely freed from the influence of the material modes of nature. So what a profound realization she's having as she's moving around this assembly. And I'll just quickly go to the next one. So there's a few more. Someone may have longevity, but not have auspiciousness or good behavior. Someone may have both auspiciousness and good behavior, but the duration of his life is not fixed. Although such demigods as Lord Shiva have eternal life, they have inauspicious habits like living in crematoriums. So he's obviously there in the assembly. She's like contemplating that. And even if others are well qualified in all respects, they are not devotees of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So in this way, next verse, after full deliberation, the goddess of fortune accepted Mukunda as her husband. Because although he is independent and not in want of her, he possesses all transcendental qualities and mystic powers and is therefore the most desirable. And then I'll read one more verse. Approaching the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the goddess of fortune, placed upon his shoulders the garland of newly grown lotus flowers, which was surrounded by humming bumblebees searching for honey. Then, expecting to get a place on the bosom of the Lord, she remained standing by his side, her face smiling in shyness. Somehow it's a very moving scene. Like when I think about that, her going around thinking about who would be the most fit person to take shelter in. And then she approaches Vishnu and she's standing there she puts a garland over him and she's expecting to get a place on the bosom of the Lord. Like, that she knows, because Krishna is very much reciprocator with his devotees. She expects that he's going to take her in and hold her close. When we say like bosom buddy, right? It means close, like a heart friend, like carrying you close. And so she has that trust that now that she's given her heart to him, he's going to hold her close. And actually it's described that Vishnu is always like Lakshmi Devi always resides on his chest in a way, you know, like that. She's always very close to him. So she knew that he was a trustworthy person to put all her faith in. Did you have something, Kelly?
She was saying that Mukunda was not in want of her. Yeah. So why was, and he was fully independent. So why was he there in the assembly?
Well, he's there in the assembly as part of the this Leela unfolding. He's part of, you know, all the demigods and all the different, he's, you know, part of, he has his own Vishnu Loka. He's there as part of his, as part of the pastime. But he, when it says he's not in want of her, I also noticed that and I thought it's very, what it means is that Krishna's independent of us, like in a way he's self, he's already self-contained and already complete. He's not in want, he's not not in need of someone, not lacking. It's not like a, oh, I need that person. You know, that typical thing we see in movies like, oh my God, that person completes my life. Like I was, you know, kind of adrift and now that, it's like, there's like a hole in that person. Like, oh, now they're my kind of this codependent sort of unhealthy function, you know, unhealthy relationship. So Krishna doesn't have that. He's not in that need of anyone to be completely self-contained and fulfilled. And at the same time, as we see in the next verse, she's expecting to get a place close to him because she knows that Krishna is, he's not in need of anyone, but he's so eager to reciprocate and bring in close his devotees. Like he wants us. It's just not done out of like an empty, desperate kind of lacking of any kind. So he's self-fulfilled in that way. Okay, so should we go through the whole purport, or because of time, should we just? Okay. Let's go to text 23, 21, and let's do the purport here for this. And someone can read. We have three paragraphs, so three different people can read a paragraph. Nanda, do you want to start?
The statement Dharma Kwachit Tatra Nabhuta Sohridam is very important in this verse. We actually see that there are many Hindus, Muslims, Christians, Buddhists, and religionists of other cults who adhere to their religious principles very nicely, but are not equal to all living entities. Indeed, although they profess to be very religious, they kill poor animals. Such religion has no meaning. Srimad Bhagavatam 1.2.8 says, one may be very expert in following the religious principles of his own sect, but if he has no tendency to love the Supreme Personality of Godhead, his observance of religious principles is simply a waste of time. One must develop a sense of loving Vasudeva Sarvamiti Samahatma Sudurlava. The sign of a devotee is that he is a friend to everyone, Suhridam Sarvabhutanam. A devotee will never allow a poor animal to be killed in the name of religion. This is the difference between a superficially religious person and a devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Okay, and one other person can read. Yeah, go for it.
We find that there have been many great heroes in history, but they could not escape from the cruel hands of death. Even the greatest hero cannot escape from the ruling power of the Supreme Personality of Godhead when Krishna comes at death. That is described by Krishna himself. Mrityo Sarvaharas Chayaham, the Lord appearing as death takes away a hero's so-called power. Even Hiranyakashipu could not be saved when Nishimadeva appeared before him as death. One's material strength is nothing before the strength of the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
Mm-hmm. So you can see here, Prabhupada's giving a few examples. Like he mentions what Kevin said earlier about the different religious movements not necessarily practicing this kindness towards all living entities. And of course, there are people of these religions who do. So we have to remember that as well. But just as a general principle, there's a lot of meat eating going on in different religions. And then he also mentions how no one can escape death. So those were the two things we had talked about. So if we are going to look for like a soulmate or a best friend or something like that, wouldn't it be great to have someone who's not going to die? Like Krishna, like everyone, and even the demigods, they have a expiration date on their time in heaven. So as she's going around the assembly, like even when you think about it in terms of who can be your eternal partner, no one except for Krishna, right? Because Krishna is the only one who's there forever, and time doesn't affect Krishna because Krishna is the controller of time. So I want to just talk a little more about, there's a few things that came to mind when I was thinking about why she chose Vishnu. And in our current time period, like in the last, actually about 1,000 years ago, there was a Benedictine monk whose name was Anselm. And he had this quote. He was in the Catholic Church. He was a philosopher. And he has this quote. It's a little bit esoteric, but just listen, see if you can catch it. He said, "God is that, comma, the greater than which cannot be conceived." So God is that, the greater than which cannot be conceived. And he was doing this in the context of proving God. He had this whole like really cool philosophy on how he actually like wrote out the different ways that we can prove God's existence. And I'm not going to really get into that now, but I wanted to mention that quote because she's going around looking, and the greatest personality, and like beyond even he was saying it in the context of, if you can imagine the most amazing person as if you would want for like a friend or a family member, right? Just picture like that quality and everything. Then even greater than that is that person actually existing in reality. So God actually existing in reality, that concept is greater than just an imagination of God, but like God actually existing. So her, somehow that just came to mind. It's maybe not as a direct of a link here, but I wanted to just mention that because she's looking for the greatest person, right? And then there was that famous philosopher Nietzsche, who said that he would only believe in a God who, do you remember? It's on Kalakanta Prabhu's book. Yeah, God Who Dances. He said that I would only believe in a God who can dance. So again, if you're thinking about what's the highest idea of God, like the best kind of person you could imagine, then anything beyond that is not I'm not explaining this very well, but God has to be greater than anything that you can imagine at the top. Like you can't outdo God, basically. So if you can think of a personal person who also dances and also plays flute and is also loving and all that, then you can't think of something necessarily greater than that, right? So that's the ultimate aspect of Krishna, the ultimate form of God in the way we know him. No one's equal or greater. Yeah. No one's equal to or greater than him. Yeah. And there was a British officer who went around India once, and he's also determined that of all the gods, he was kind of confused by all the different gods in the temples. And he said that the one who's playing the flute, that must be the ultimate god, because he's not doing anything. The other ones are doing things like controlling this planet or doing that or taking care of all their devotees, having a trident or different things. But God's like the ultimate aspect of God that he saw in India was a flute player, because he's just enjoying. So I wanted to ask this question of just for us to think about why we choose Krishna. So like we see how Lakshmi chose Vishnu, and in our life, why have we chosen Krishna? And it's something very personal for each one of us. Like why of all the aspects of God, even why are we choosing Krishna? And so I wanted to read this. This is an amazing thing, that this letter that Prabhupada wrote. We had read from it on the campus on Wednesday night. I had forgotten this. This is such an amazing letter. In 1973, Prabhupada received an unusual letter from a woman in California who had encountered two of his young disciples. She complained they had a very negative outlook toward the people they met. Moved by her genuine concern, Prabhupada took time out from his busy schedule to write her a thoughtful letter. And he wrote her a letter of like four pages, I mean, in this book, I mean, it's like five pages long, very long letter. She had just written a little thing like, hey, I met two of your boys at Kmart. They seem to have a very negative outlook on life. And she was disapproving of that. She said, we happen to represent God and, you know, we should be careful how we handpick the people or whatever. You know, she's kind of just giving a little critique of that experience. And so Prabhupada wrote this really loving letter back to her. And he says, please forgive my disciples for any unkindness or indiscretion on their part. Anyway, it's a great letter. If you want to read the whole thing, it's on page 267 of Science of Self-Realization. Anyway, so in that letter, he says something, Prabhupada writes here, everyone wants to repose his loving tendency in some object which is in his opinion worthy. But the question is one of ignorance only, because people have a poor fund of knowledge about where to find that supreme lovable object who is actually worthy to accept and reciprocate their love. People simply do not know. There is no proper information. As soon as you have some attachment for anything material, it will kick you upon the face, deteriorate, and disappoint you. It's bound to dissatisfy and frustrate you. That's a fact. But these young boys in your country and all over the world are accepting. Yes, that is a fact. And they're getting the right information from Krishna. So he's talking about the disillusionment that happens when we look for Krishna in other people, right? We're like, we end up choosing Krishna, but in the meantime, when we're on our journey, we're like looking around in this world, trying to find that fulfilling person or people, the community, whatever it is that we want to find that fulfillment. And I'm curious if anyone here has felt disillusionment from social interactions, like who here has ever experienced that in their life? Okay, only a few of you. Not everyone? Okay, so it's great. Some of you haven't yet. but yes, so whenever we put our attachment on any person in this world and we want to make them basically God to us, like we want to completely devote ourselves to them and we want them to devote themselves to us, it's never going to be fulfillment, because it's either that is going to end up kicking on our face in some kind of dramatic way, or it might be rosy and beautiful, but it's going to end with the passage of time. So either way, it's never like really ultimately fulfilling, right? So he's talking about that. And so then he says, by surrendering to Krishna, one will find the final object in which to invest his love. Love of God is present in everyone, just like fire in an unlit match, but it's covered over. But if one somehow or other develops his dormant love of God and Krishna becomes his supreme adorable object, supreme friend, supreme master, or supreme lover, then he shall never again become disappointed or unhappy. So I'll just read that last sentence again. And just close your eyes for a moment. Just really take this in, really listen to this. If one somehow or other develops his dormant love of God and Krishna becomes his supreme adorable object, supreme friend, supreme master, or supreme lover, then he shall never again become disappointed or unhappy. Rather, because his loving propensity is rightfully placed, he's always enjoying great satisfaction and bliss. Okay, so yeah, I think most, I know that not everyone raised their hand here, but I'm pretty sure that at some point in your life, you've been disappointed by something in this world. And the Prabhupada's saying here that the solution to that disappointment is to turn our affection over to Krishna. So I just want to ask a question though. Does that mean we kind of like go, oh, well, I'm done with this. I've been burned too many times by relationships. I'm out of here. Like I'm done with that. And I'm just like focused on Krishna. What do you think?
No, it's just being intelligent. So if something's clearly not working, there is something that you just have to look inside and figure out what's wrong. So if the material world's not treating you right, it's not to just let it go, but just figure out, okay, well, why am I not happy? What's wrong here?
So like becoming more contemplative and like trying to understand what's going on here instead of just like ditching it. Yeah, that's a good point. Anything else? Any other thoughts about that? So we're reading here that when we put our affection or attention on people in this world or objects of this world, that we get, at the end of the day, we get kicked in the face or discouraged or hurt in some way. So I was asking, like, what does that mean for us? Does that mean that we should just kind of... So when you genuinely love... Yeah, right. So it's not just me and you, Krishna. So when you genuinely love Krishna, you love everyone else. That's a really good answer. Any other thoughts on that question?
If like somebody is seeking answers and also like entangled in the material world, like it can get hard to find those answers. So that's why I think a balance is good, to be, and like, be spiritual and also like loving to all other people, all relationships in your life.
Nice. Thank you. Yeah. Kevin.
Yeah, I'm thinking that we're going to need relationships anyway. Even if we have been hurt and we say, no, you know what, like, I'm not doing relationships again. I'm going to stay away from people, or I'm going to close off. We're not going to be fulfilled, and we're going to engage in relationships anyway, but hurting others and hurting ourselves because we can't stay away from them.
Really good point. Yeah. So it's kind of an artificial renunciation. That's not going to last. It's going to end up, because souls are, they want to be of service to others. They want to be in connection with others. We're not meant to be just like these singular entities floating around in our own little world. Although some people really aspire for that and they end up in the Brahma Jyoti and the effulgence. They're kind of just like freedom from people or whatever, but even that doesn't last. They get bored, they get restless. They want to come back down to this world and do charity work and so on. So that's a really good point. Radhika, did you have something? Oh, was there another one back? Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, I didn't see you. Oh.
Just wanted to say that, like, Krishna and Chaitanya's mood was very much like, we need to serve the servant of the servant of the servant. And everyone's, like, true nature when they're, when you take away, like, all the conditioning that's covering their soul is to be, like, a servant of Krishna.
Thank you. Yeah.
I think, you know, I agree with like what Gopal was saying, that we love others because they're also servants of Krishna. If you love Krishna, you love others. But even though we engage in these relationships, I think what's important is what we were just talking about, is we don't have that expectation like, this person is going to fulfill me. We engage in these relationships, but at the same time we realize really like Krishna is a shelter. I'm just engaging in these relationships as a service, or because, you know, this is what will be pleasing to him. But don't repose like all of your expectations of this one person. This person's going to satisfy me, fulfill me.
And I like that you said the word repose, because that's I looked up the definition because Prabhupada had mentioned it in this letter. And one of the definitions is seeking shelter after a state of resting after a lot of exertion or strain. So like our experience in this world we might be having that experience with relationships, like things might not work so smoothly, and then the final repose of that is like there's sort of a peacefulness that comes from putting it in the right place. But I love what you said about connecting others to Krishna, and that's how it all works nicely, because we're kind of keeping them in the Krishna at the center, and the others are parts of Krishna, so we never get lost in that other person and making them central. So we're not grasping onto people, we're just like serving and like with open hands, kind of letting the souls come in and being of service, but not like trying to hold on to anybody in particular with a lot of attachment. So I was thinking my answer to the question would be that relationships are an opportunity for us to practice our relationship with Krishna, because that's really for a personal movement. And the impersonal approach is to be like, I'm done with people. I'm out of here. That's impersonal because it's easier. personalism is harder. It makes us confront our own baggage and our own stuff. Like when we're in, you know, that rock tumblers, when you put in your little rocks that are not tumbled, that are not smooth. And I had one as a kid, actually. We had a little rock tumbler, and it takes a while. And you're just kind of like some water and all the rocks smash each other around, and then they come out like nice and smooth. So that's kind of what ashram life is like. And that's what life with other devotees can feel like. Sometimes it can be like, okay, it's amplifying those areas where we need to smooth ourselves more, and we need to purify ourselves more. And it's a beautiful, wonderful thing, but can be also a source of angst and frustration at times, right? So relationships are an opportunity for us to practice our relationship with Krishna. So that was one thing that came to mind. And then one last thing that I want to ask you all is, what is it about Krishna? Why? And you can just take a moment to like think about this, is maybe even just close your eyes for a moment, really tap into your own experience of Krishna consciousness. What is it about Krishna? Why do you choose Krishna? What aspect of Krishna is what keeps you here? Like, why do you take your shelter in Krishna? So just take a moment and think about that. And then if you'd like to, you can share why you chose Krishna. Okay, so does everyone have something? Raise your hand if something came to mind for you. Some are still thinking, kind of on the, it's forming, right? It takes some time. Okay, so one, I'll just share first, and then you're still thinking, can think about this. So one thing that there could be more than one, obviously, right? It's not just one reason that we choose Krishna. One for me is that the thing that really draws me to Krishna is how personally he interacts with every single living entity. I think that is what draws me the most in a person, like it's someone who I want to take shelter in, someone who's able to personally interact with every living entity in the way that's unique for their journey. That's something that came to me. So anyone else like to share what? Yes, Prabhu.
One thought comes to mind is, even if I forget about him, he never forgets about me.
Yeah, that's really touching, right? Like we can do anything and Krishna's still there. He never lets us go. Okay. Kaylee and then Arjuna.
So my big thing is like Sankirtan, going out and connecting with people and reminding people of Krishna, because I lived at a yoga silent meditation ashram where it was more like this impersonalism. And so, yeah, we were, you know, teaching consciousness, higher consciousness to people, but it was people that were already kind of like pious and all these things. And I wanted to go out and meet people that have never even thought about yoga or like are not even thinking about this stuff. So Sankirtan was what really kind of drew me into Krishna specifically and the Krishna consciousness, and then sharing it with people.
What comes to mind when you said that is that when we share Krishna, we experience Krishna more. It's yes. Like he becomes more alive to us as we give him to others. So thank you for mentioning that. Arjuna, yeah, in the back.
I think the reason I chose Krishna is because I like his devotees a lot. And I think that's the reason a lot of people do is like in the beginning, they just like kind of make friendships with the devotees here. And it's not like they have some fired experience with chanting. It's just like they like the devotees, and over time they get more attached to Krishna personally.
Yeah, such a great point that sometimes it starts from the souls we encounter and then goes, more often happens that way. I was just talking to somebody about this and like what kind of draws people nowadays. I don't think it's so much the philosophy of religion. I mean, some people are drawn to that, but I think what people are really craving nowadays, because there's so much loneliness in this world, is to find that kinship. And so then their affection for Krishna grows through that company. Lo.
Everyone else said something like super profound, but what really like makes me so happy is that Krishna's like a giant scary kitty cat sometimes, and I don't know, I just, that really like solidifies that like Krishna is God. I don't know, just like that he has like all these different forms, and like one of his like most, one of his like best devotees, Tulsi, is like also like just in the material world. There's just so much mercy in that.
Yeah, so the fact that Krishna has many different aspects to him that we can find. Yeah, just, I was thinking about Nrisingadev and that when you said that, and just, or Tulsi Devi, there's different aspects, different ways that we can approach Krishna. Nishtha.
I think I choose Krishna because he's so reliable. Like, you can always turn to him, like, no matter what you're going through. Like, he's, like, always there, like, 24-7 and accessible through the Mala Mantra. Mm. So I find that very attractive and unique. You can't find that anywhere else.
Yeah, very dependable. What a nice point. Anyone else want to share why? Yes, Kamisha.
I think for me, is he's very compassionate. He always, doesn't matter what you're doing, he never see the faults. He always see the good and try to encourage you to like be more close to him. So I really like.
Yeah. He never sees the fault, he only sees the good. Kevin? We'll just do a couple more and then we'll wrap up. This is really nice to hear why people choose Krishna. I think it's really cool.
He's like one of the only people that isn't dealing with mental health issues. So it's like, it's really good to have a relationship and see his activities and his dealings in a very healthy way. It's very nice because often we see many interactions and, you know, with the people around us and ourselves, and we don't always deal with it nicely, but all his dealings are always so nice because he's just so healthy.
Yeah, I like that. He's just very healthy. In all ways, yeah. Yeah. You go ahead. Yeah.
So my appreciation for Krishna grew here when I came here, obviously. Mostly because I was already involved in a bhakti practice beforehand, right? You know, chanting Hanuman Chalisa and appreciating the Ramayana. And Krishna let me have like this aspect of control to like deepen my practice with those things. But ultimately, I'm sitting here right now, and I was fortunate to come here from like circumstances that provided stimuli to want to come here. Mm. And there's no accidents in this business, so
mm-hmm.
Very good.
Very nice. Happy to have you here. Chris, yeah, go ahead.
I think it's so mystical that. Krishna is like a flute player, and he has like he's in communion with nature so deeply, and also he reaches out to his devotees through our devotion and our actions.
Yeah. And anyone, let me just call on somebody. See, Shruti. Why do you choose Krishna?
Well, I was thinking I choose Krishna because of his devotees, so the Vaishnava Acharyas, and how the Acharyas especially are like a channel of his kindness. So that's primarily why.
Channel of his kindness. That's nice. Christina, why do you choose Krishna?
I choose Krishna because it really just answers my questions about like what reality is. And what we're all doing here. when I first started reading Bhagavad Gita as it is, I realized that the description of Krishna in Bhagavad Gita really made much more sense as a description of the Supreme Being than any other explanation of a Supreme Being that I'd been given before. Like, I was thinking, you know, I grew up Christian, but there's always this question of like, well, why, if there's a supreme omnipotent being, then why would that person or that being ever be angry? Like, that just didn't really make sense to me. Like, especially angry at people who are just trying to do what you're trying their best, you know? And so when I read about Krishna, who's like everyone's friend and who is self-satisfied and who doesn't, you know, get angry at devotees or people who are just trying their best, I was like, oh yeah, that makes a lot more sense.
Mm. Thank you. So I wanted to end on, was there anything, did anybody else want to share that? Oh, Chris, yes.
I choose Krishna because of the reciprocation and the magnitude of the reciprocation is like way larger than the love that we put into the relationship, and that in anything is the proof that the process works.
Mm, very nice.
Gopi Jivana said, I choose Krishna because of what his holy names and his followers had already undeniably done in my life. If I can't see or acknowledge that transformation, then I am just being immensely foolish. If I am sane at all, I must admit that something very real is happening and that I need to keep diving deeper.
Mm. Very powerful. Okay, I want to ask one person, Nanda. Why do you choose Krishna?
Two things. Well, several things, but I think as Bhagavan, all of his qualities, the most important one is renunciation, which merely means not trying to possess others or get something from them. Or, you know, mm-hmm. There's that detachment, which doesn't mean indifference, but is he detached in the sense that he wants there to be a free exchange of love rather than trying to just get something out of somebody. So that I appreciate. And well, yeah, and just he, I know it sounds, it's like he actually is perfect. You know, this just the description and how he behaves and all the descriptions of him as Bhagavan, and then how he reciprocates accordingly, that there are so many relationships that can just go deeper and deeper. He's not just a God who sits around angry, as Christina said.
Mm.
And as Kevin said, he doesn't have mental health issues. He's not, again, possessive. He's actually having an actual loving exchange. And that doesn't, and part of his loving exchange is doing what's best for us, even if we may not like it at first. So he knows what's good for us, and he helps us to fix whatever we need to fix. And it may be painful sometimes, but if he were attached, he wouldn't try to help us fix those things, because then we might get mad at him, and he's too needy to have someone mad at him. So he doesn't want them to be mad at him. So he just lets them get away with anything, but he actually isn't. He wants what's best for us, and he does whatever's necessary to do what's best for us. So there's not this attachment to us behaving in a way that's just beneficial to his false ego or something. And I was actually going to mention also that point that Anselm, the argument that Anselm made, Priyadana Maharaj compared that to Rupa Goswami's, I don't know if you've ever heard him talk about this, mm-hmm. Rupa Goswami's description of Krishna as the that he's better than everyone else in the sense that the 64 qualities, right? So it's like the Jivas have 50, some of the demigods have 55, and then Narayan has 60, and then Krishna has 64. And so he kind of proves that same argument by a list of qualities, that if you can imagine all the greatest beings, he's the best by four extra qualities. So he does it by numbers, but it's like he's showing that no one else has these other qualities that he has. And that's what, so whatever being you can imagine, that's the greatest, he's greater. And that's, this is the proof that he's greater because he has these qualities that they don't have.
Nice. Yeah. Thanks for adding that. Yeah. I want to just end, we'll, and then we'll have breakfast. I wanted to do one little song together. And then because this bhajan reminds me a lot of what we talked about, how there's disillusionment in the world. And then there's finding our repose in Krishna and our comfort in spiritual life. So we'll just do it with hand clapping and everyone can kind of clap. I like the melody that Yamuna Devi sings. So she actually sang the first part backwards, but we'll sing it because she didn't know the words so well. So she sang Bajamana Hure, but it's actually Bajahure Mana. So we'll kind of switch that up, but otherwise we'll do her melody. And you can just look at the words, the English, and you'll see how it ties in with this whole thing. So Bajamana Hure. I said it wrong. Okay, let's start again. It's so ingrained in my head. Okay. And I'll sing and then you can follow. Okay. So you can every clap. Baja Hure Mama. Shri Nandanandana Abhaya Charana Ravindare. Dulabhamanava Janama Satsange. Dulabhamanava Janama Satsange. Tara hoye bhava sindure. Shita ata pavata parishana. Edina jamini jagire. Bipale sevinu kripana durajana. Chapala sukala vala gire. Edana jovana putra parijana. Ite ki ache parati tire. Kamala dala jala jivana kalamala. Kamala dala jala jivana kalamala. Bajahu hari parani tire. Shravana kirtana smarana vandana. Pada sevana dasya re. Pujana sakhi jana atmani vedana. Govinda dasa bhilasa re. So Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Thank you all.